We have more Inside Wealth and Out right here on Talk 910 AM, KNEW San Francisco. We're here with Matt Emmons, CEO of Shire Pharmaceuticals and co-author with Beth Kephart of Zenobia, The Curious Book of Business, a tale of triumph over yes men, cynics, hedgers, and other corporate killjoys. And last segment, we finished off talking about how the protagonist in the book is going through this maze and how different she is. And there are so many lessons in this book, Matt. One has to do with taking risks. How do you, and you mentioned that last time, in last segment also, in terms of, you know, the problem with that is many people in corporations start sentences with like that as an indication of their unwillingness to take risk.
Or to compete with somebody else. they want to compete with them, yeah.
Right, and obviously sometimes people just find it easier to find, you know, poke holes and find ways to say no rather than ways to say yes.
But absolutely.
So in general, how do you learn, or can you learn, to become a risk taker?
Well, I think companies have sure tried that, and I think fairly unsuccessfully if you look at history. I'm certain I've been doing this for 35 years, and I've been in three or four different companies, and I've certainly talked to a lot of people about it and been a guest speaker here and there. But, you know, making a T-shirt and saying I'm an entrepreneur, or, you know, one of my favorite lines is, let's take prudent risks. Well, mm-hmm. Prudent is who sees it is a question that's interesting. But basically what we try to do in Zenobia is take the viewpoint of an individual, in this case a young woman, to make her as different as possible. We dressed her up kind of funny, and these are all metaphorical clues to somebody that's going to act differently. If you act the same inside a company, nothing really is going to change, and you're not going to have an impact, and we won't reach our mythical room 133A in the book, and that's the, you know, the ultimate goal of fulfillment. So what we thought about is, what does it feel like to be different, to have an idea? And, you know, people ridicule you. What is it? What are you looking at? You're looking at things that no longer work, things that really a company, an organization, or any size needs to move on, that the organization itself prevents from happening. So as you do that, you are challenging certain tenets, some of which are established by people you work for, and you may be crossing organizational boundaries, and you may put yourself at personal risk. What does that feel like? What does that look like? Can you get used to that, and can you ultimately accept the fact that your beliefs may cause you not to work there anymore, if you take it to the extreme? And that's a liberating moment. If I can tell you, I had one in my career in which I finally said, no, I believe I'm right, and I'm going to leave, and, you know, then they were falling all over themselves for me to stay. But that was a liberating moment, because I learned that you have to really push it to the edge to make a change and to make a difference. And through the eyes of this young lady, Maura, she sees an organization that's ill, old, misconnected. She sees representations of people that stop new ideas. She sees somebody walking down the hall with the machine of the here and now, we call it, but basically here's what you're going to do today. And then there's people in another room doing PowerPoints, and they're all looking backwards. Looking forward is a very scary thing to a lot of people, and a lot of times when new ideas come, nobody wants to hitch their kite to that, because if it fails, somebody, you know, they're going to get blamed, but if it's successful, they might not get the accolade. So it's a very good look to this woman's eyes as she responds to this ad and tries to find this gentleman to interview at the top floor. She sees all these kind of wild people, but they're representative of what really can happen. Companies that squash ideas, tell you you're no good, make you feel inferior, try to put you in a box, etc., from change. Change is very threatening.
So if we can ground it a little bit, let's say some of our listeners who are actually gainfully employed at a company that may sound like one of these companies,
yep,
where there's a lot of structure in place. On one hand, yes, we all know that innovation is important. On the other hand, there is, you know, there are kind of rigid boundaries, and in many cases, as you pointed out, if you invite change, you may be bearing all the risk and not even get the credit if it works, because the,
yep,
superior may do that one for you.
Yep.
And so what do you say to somebody and who may be listening right now, actually, and to encourage them to as you had done in your career, take that stand? And that is scary for people, because they may lose their job over it, conceivably. You don't know.
Yeah, well, I think that there's a situation where you can let a company define your boundaries and your goals and how you act. And I think that's not what you're paid for, especially as you get in managerial positions. But when you take the responsibility to act to your heart and say, I know this is the right thing, I think that's what this book's about. It's really an internal look at what I need to do, what I really believe. If you're at odds with those two things of what is expected and what you believe, you're not going to be a happy employee. You're not going to achieve what you expect in your life. And in fact, you may get fired anyway because they don't think you add anything. It's kind of a double-edged sword. So what Zenobia talks about is a company that's way out of date. It's basically building buggy whips, and there's no demand anymore. It's not really doing that. You have to read the book to find out. But it's another metaphor. But it's somebody walking in there and seeing it for what it is and not taking no for an answer. When you talk about yield nothing to those that can't get past themselves, basically it talks about the guy that comes for the interview that's trying to impress what is, and she comes trying to make what can be of the company, and it is ultimately recognized. And, you know, it's a fable, so it has a happy ending and looks into the future, in a very bright way. But I think a lot of the things that happened to this young lady along the way caused people to think about, am I being molded by what I'm in, or am I here to mold what it can be in a world that's changing? I mean, basically, companies, the minute they're set up or organization structures or whatever, the next day, outdated. They were done for yesterday. And when you get massive, large organizations, it can take, they can be out of date 10 years, 15, 20 years in their model. And people still with an internal focus will cause that model to be very hard to move.
We are here with Matt Emmons, who not only is an author of Zenobia, he's also a practicing CEO at Shire Pharmaceuticals, a company that's done very well. It's a $10 billion market cap type company. So please listen, because this man is walking the talk in a big way. Matt, something else came to mind as you were talking, and that is implicit in what you're saying is, you know, life is kind of short, or can be. And it's so easy for us to settle for what we, you know, our horizons as dictated by what we think business as usual is, or conforming to what we're being told to do. And what you are encouraging and empowering people to do is to not take no for an answer and to follow what they know in their heart to be true, which hopefully could be in the best interest of the organization as well, not just being self-centered.
I believe it usually is if it's allowed to come out, and if people take on one person's idea and build on it with another group of people, it usually gets stronger inside of a company.
You know, you talked about looking not just for what could be, not looking at what could be and not just what is.
Yep.
Why don't you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, I think that all wealth and all company profits, which are ultimately somebody's wealth, hopefully shareholders or owners, comes from an idea. If you think about it, it really comes from software. The company and the organizational structure and how we have meetings and all the things we do every day are basically hardware. I mean, that's set up and that's done. But if you think about where money generates, it's a new idea. It's Jobs with the iPod. It's the original idea of the PC. It's cell phones. It's GPS navigation in your car. It's all these. Somebody had this idea. And when they had this idea, I'm sure that somebody looked at them and said, you are out of your mind, because it does not yet exist. And therefore, it can be either a fantasy or these people can be perceived as delusional. There's been talk of the mass hallucination, the ability of certain leaders to create something that's not real into something that people can touch is the magic, because almost anything's possible if people really believe in it and you put enough capital into it, you can probably make it happen. But there's an innate resistance in large organizations to that kind of change, because it threatens what has made other people successful, and it threatens that hardware, that architecture that's been put in place that's comforting for many. And they don't want that to blow up. Somehow there seems to be less risk of that if that gets old and outdated than if you come in with a totally new idea, which I think is exactly backwards. There's probably more risk just sitting there and not changing.
Well, there are a lot of structures in place in our world today, not just in corporate structure, that also has power bases that are threatened. If they were truly to let go and allow for change and presence to pour forth.
whether politically or even in religious structures, right?
Yes, and I would say just in the financing structure, it's interesting to me to watch really breakthrough ideas that have become world-changing. The PC, the things I just named, but I can think of many, many inventions over the years that have done this, are not readily recognized early except by a few really high-risk venture capitalists. But the markets don't recognize them initially. They follow it. And that's another kind of weight that you drag along. It's their world, and they know what they're doing there, but they don't understand fundamentally your business or what your vision is until it does create value, and then they can, you know, you can make a model out of that, and you can make a line going in a certain direction at a certain slope, and all of a sudden it makes sense.
Sure. Well, there are all kinds of people out there. In fact, I understand that one of the major VCs out there uses as their criterion for investing a glimmer of greatness. if they can see a glimmer of greatness in the idea, not necessarily the business model, models can change, but in the idea and the concept of the service or product to be provided, if there's this opportunity of ubiquity, internationalization, globalization, they may very well bet on the horse. So it's kind of confirming what you're talking about.
The kind of people I love.
Yeah, no doubt.
You know, financially, it's kind of interesting. Within a company, just as outside, companies spend a lot of energy measuring what has been, and I think very little energy in trying, they're going to do, you know, we do long-range planning and we do strategic planning, but basically, what are the ideas, the fundamental idea that's going to be different for the future, especially when you're in an environment that's changing? Our world is, you know, it just keeps going faster and faster.
Sure.
You know, you've got to be ahead of it. And I don't think companies spend enough time thinking about that and honoring unique ideas. I, as one that has had some unique ideas over the years, I can treat it as it's usually a threat or a yawn. either way, it's probably not going anywhere because it's not understood.
So Matt, at Shire, how do you instill a culture that allows for these new ideas to be generated and you know, encouraged?
Well, as you know, the pharmaceutical business is under pretty tough times. If you look at both market caps, which is driven by their pipelines and their potential for growth, and a feeling politically that there's going to be much more pressure on pricing and things. So the industry is not in great shape. One of the reasons I went to a small company like Shire, when I started 5 years ago, we've tripled the market cap. We're now over $10 billion. But we went to an area that we thought was underutilized, and we looked at the world a little differently. We said, let's try to get low-risk development, long patents, in areas that are not billion-dollar products, but maybe half-billion-dollar products. And that's not enough to move the needle of the big guys.
Sure.
So it was kind of a niche in the middle. And we chose two things. One is products that generally had proven mechanisms of action or had been used in another indication. And secondly, we chose areas that people might not think we want to go into, like orphan drugs. We had a slogan inside the company called, the overall thing is brave, but basically fearless. We want a fearless culture. And we kind of relate pharmaceuticals a bit like wildcat oil well drilling. And we want to be a step up the ladder from that, where we're not, at least we kind of know where it is, where we're digging the holes, not where we're going just to a blank field. But still, it's a pretty risky business, and people have to make decisions every day. And we wanted people to all participate in those decisions and be able to speak freely about them. So we've done now two huge deals for us, multi-billion-dollar deals, one almost three, one almost two. And we bought some companies, and I got to tell you, the market had to follow us into that. The first one we did, we went down 15-20% in market cap over a two-week period, and the market kind of got it. We came back even, and ultimately 6 months later, that pushed us to our first doubling of the stock. So, again, if it was widely recognized externally as the next thing you're going to do, in the context of the way they saw it, A, it would be too expensive for us, and they would, or B, they would have expected it and it would already been in the stock. So it's kind of interesting to see that kind of reaction. It lets you know that you did something they didn't expect. And I think you have to do the unexpected in business. If you do the expected, you're going to be mediocre.
I hear you loud and clear. In fact, we're just about winding up our segment, which is going so fast, Matt. But, you know, I wanted to follow up with you on the notion of fearlessness.
Yep.
Because so many of us live in some aspect of fear.
Yep.
And you mentioned actually in the book this piece of sage advice. Sometimes fear is a choice you can choose not to make.
Yeah, I've been looked at fear a lot in my life in terms of the work environment. And I think most fear is unrealistic fear. Many people think if they do something wrong or different, they're going to get fired. They're going to die. I mean, they act like they're going to die. What's the worst you can do? You might get fired. You know, you were looking for a job when you got the one you have. That's not so bad. You're going to live through that. If you look at great entrepreneurs, most of them have failed at least three times before they're successful because they got over that fear of failure. What's real failure? I think if you die or if your family's hurt or injured or if you develop some chronic disease that's gradually going to take your mind away, maybe that's fear. I don't think business has the number of things that can scare you as much as everybody thinks it can.
Matt Emmons, thank you so much for joining us. Everybody, come to our website at InsideWealth.net. We'll have a link to Matt and his book, wonderful book, Zenobia. Matt, thanks for sharing.
Thank you.
We have more wealth to share right here on KNEW, 910 AM, San Francisco.